Greetings, groovers, seekers of sophistication, lovers of literature. How are you doing? This is Resonance 104.4 FM, flipping marvellous. I'm Nick Hennigan, and welcome to another extravaganza that is Literary London, where we look at things literary happening in London. Yeah, makes sense, doesn't it? I hope you've had a good week. We're about to celebrate in this programme, and in fact next week as well, and possibly even the week after, a theatrical maverick. His name was Ken Campbell. And actually, after I got back from the Edinburgh Festival, we recorded this show at the British Library, live. The show is called Pigspert's Daughter. If you're a Fringe regular, you'll know the name Ken Campbell. He was an actor. Well, in fact, I won't tell you too much about him because Daisy's going to tell you all about him later on. But to celebrate the 10th anniversary of his passing away, Daisy, Ken's daughter, put together a show. And as it says in the blurb, having grown up repeatedly watching her father Ken Campbell's one-man shows, which she says is cheaper than a babysitter, Daisy Campbell marks the 10th anniversary of her dad's death with a monologue of her own. Pigspert's Daughter, it's called, is a sort of fairly surreal quest for Daisy to go further than her father. Pigspert, by the way, is the denomic side of Ken's personality and is summoned by Daisy. And so what I thought I did, I went along to the production of this show. It's finished now, sadly, at the British Library, and I recorded it. And so, for your delight and dedication, here's the first 20-odd minutes. Enjoy.
Here, the Illuminatus trilogy by Robert Shea and Robert Anton Wilson. There are those who would say that it's all this book's fault. Immanentize the eschaton. It's an interesting turn of phrase, isn't it? Immanentize, to make more imminent the eschaton, the end of the world. I've been rereading it recently. I've been looking for clues into this weird dream that I've been having. A brick pyramid rises from a dilapidated, sooty cityscape. There's strange activity, a kind of carnival atmosphere. The rattling of supermarket trolleys, the banging of traffic cones. There's all these creatures with weird skull-like faces, and they're marauding around this enormous edifice. And then I see one of these skull creatures is holding in his hand the final brick. I realise I am already dead. I watch this whole thing from above, and I can see that this skull creature is going to climb up this enormous brick pyramid and place the final brick. And it's always at that moment that I notice there's a gap right at the bottom. There's a gap. And I'm always trying to cry out from my disembodied vantage point, there's a gap, there's a gap. But it's too late. The final brick has been placed. The gap will remain. And I am just a scream in the sky. Hello, thanks for coming. Don't worry, it's not all like that. Oh, fuck, it's been 10 years to this very day, guys. Day since the wonderful man that was my dad, Ken Campbell, theatre maverick, antic visionary, genius in the original sense of the word. These were some of the things that were said and written about him. And Christ, yeah, it's been 10 years since he died. And so that's why I'm doing this show. That's why I've been sorting through all, I mean, this here. This represents like the tiniest percentage of the crap that I'm currently trying to cope with. His archive, his weird letters, his weird scripts, parrot paintings, pigeon translations, God knows what. Now listen, some of you here I'm sure will be Ken Campbell aficionados and how lovely for you. But some of you will never have the man over the course of this evening. Don't worry about it, it's all right. So look, what can I show you? Yes, his parrot, Doris, was an artist, well, still is an artist, I assume. And she had two main schools of art. She had the pooptures and the pectures. This one here is, I would say, a poopture. This one, I don't know how well you can see it, this is called the bombing of Baghdad. what else have we got? This rather poignant one here. I don't know what this one's called. I'm sure one of you will enlighten me. But yeah, I don't know what that one's called. Yeah. And look, oh look, here's Doris. Here's Doris in the middle of one of her pictures. Mid-picture there. What else can I show you? Oh yes, in my bag. I have, here it is. His wooden tie. Yes, a wooden tie. You have to be a bit careful with the wooden tie because it gets you in the knackers when you sit down. This was used to see off an assailant in my dad's first one-man show, The Recollections of a Furtive Nudist. But there he is, seeing off said assailant. That's good, isn't it? What else have I got? Oh, yeah, and in here, man, I was happy when I found this. Oh, his fisherman's jacket. This was worn by my dad when he would do his marsh business, you see. He had an office on Hackney Marshes. It was actually basically just a picnic table. But off he'd go. He sort of had this whole fisherman's jacket specially designed for his marsh office. Off he'd go with his enormous fisherman's umbrella, so he could be there in any weather, you see. And wonderful things. So here we go. He'd keep all his dates in there. You see? What else has he got? Oh yeah, did calculations and scribblings there. Oh, that's for important stamping. Might need to stamp things. Oh yeah, for his letters. Good. This one, I assume, for taking the ladies' measurements. And in here, pictures of loved ones. Ah, yes. And I believe this might be some. Maybe in this one. Yes, my dad's ping pong ball. This was used to train young actors in how to look like you're just about to be funny in a moment. You see, just about to be funny in a moment. And his teeth. Look, he's got his teeth in here. This was in case he needed to hold an impromptu ventriloquism workshop at his marsh office, you see. Who dared to cut lip fruit that turd in our dead? No, he's dead. Was that you? You can see I wasn't his best student. There we go. And in here, yes. His dick nose. It's gone all wonky. There it is. His dick nose. Which, of course, must go along with the laughing mirror. This was my dad's cure for depression. It does kind of work. Some people called my dad mad. I'm not mad, he'd say. No, I'm not mad. I've just read different books. By the Lee Navigational that I used to live with my dad. We had a little boat called the Snark moored on the canal there. We were a minute's walk from Fred's Cafe and the rowing club. And at weekends we'd do brilliant things like we might go fishing, but not with like normal fishing tackle, but with a magnet strong enough to pick up a car. Wow, send that in, pull out all sorts of motorbikes and supermarket trolleys, all sorts of crap, fantastic. Or we might take the little snark boat and go along the canal towards the vast abandoned water purifying beds. Wow, these extraordinary things there in Enfield. And there we'd fart about, maybe make a little film or something. And afterwards, I'd get an orange by the neck at the Anchor and Hope pub while my dad held forth to the local gong gooslers. Yeah, when I was young and ever so sweet, he was a brilliant dad. It was when I was 15 or so, he got this gig for Channel 4. It was a documentary series called Brain Spotting. And the central question of it was this: where or what is our self? "Where do you see me?" he'd say. "Oh, yeah, yeah, I'm up here on the stage, yeah. No, but where do you see me?" Oh, don't worry, this is kind of how he talked. Right, "in your eyes, yeah, in your eyes, and then what? And then that's relayed into your head, is it? Onto some kind of screen? And then what? There's a little geezer who's watching the screen. Is that you? Is that yourself?" "No, but you see, the chaps who get paid to ponder these things, they say, 'Oh, no, no, because that's ridiculous, because then there must be another little geezer inside that geezer who's watching a teaching little screen, and then another little geezer inside that one, and a little geezer inside that one.' Anyway, it's ridiculous. And anyway, cranial surgeons can't find that bitch. They can take the top of your head off and ping a bit here and your left leg goes up, or pang a bit there and you're talking about your granny. But they can't find any you, any self. And it's a thing we need, the self. A thing we think must be there, but a thing we haven't yet found. No, 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 maybe it was in his search to discover the self that he signed himself up for the Robert McKee Story Structure Course. Robert McKee, the original screenwriting guru. He's this brusque, suave, straight-talking American who does these legendary three-day intensive screenwriting seminars. He's still doing them now, almost into his 80s. And anyway, my dad took me along to the Robert McKee Story Structure Course when I was 11. And although I spent most of these 12-hour days doodling princesses, I mean, something went in, I think. And anyway, after that, me and my dad, we mostly spoke in story structure. "Any chance of an inciting incident today, Daisy? Or are you staying in bed?" "No, no, I'm staying in bed. Give me a shout when we're at the third act climax." Or on long car journeys in his little blue Morris Minor, he'd quiz me on story structure jargon. "What's a setup?" "It's the bit of the story that seems relatively unimportant." "Yeah, and then what's a payoff?" "It's when it turns out that it was important." I also did Robert McKee's horror course, but I can only remember something about a vagina with teeth. I was probably a bit young for it. Anyway, we learned from McKee that you have to take stories to the end of the line. And to do this, you've got to find what McKee calls the negation of the negation. So let's say you've got a story and it's told along a certain value line. Let's say love and separation, yeah? So here's one end of the line, love. Okay, so we've got a detail that this is some kind of special love, something unique and a bit different, something we haven't seen before, okay. And then the other end of the line, separation. Well, what are we going to go for? Death? Yeah, right, but we know that story, don't we? I mean, we're trying to find the negation of the negation. Maybe it's the loss of the memories of the loved one. Or maybe it's the realization that the loved one wasn't who you thought they were. Or maybe it's the realization that it's you and not they who are, in fact, anyway, whatever, whatever. The point is, you're trying to find the negation of the negation. Dad loved this. Poor playwright pals who've made the mistake of inviting Ken to their opening night would get nobbled in the bar afterwards as he'd say to them, "Now listen, your problem is you haven't found the negation of the negation." We also learned from McKee about the gap. Your story happens in the gap. The gap is what exists between your expectation of what should reasonably happen in a reasonable universe populated by reasonable people and what actually happens. So for example, you knock on a door, the person that you're expecting to answer the door answers the door, no story. They say all the things that you're expecting them to say, no story. Now, you knock on a door, but there's no answer. But you try the oh, it's open. So you go inside. There's shit and feathers all over the walls. And the strange sound of whining coming from next door. You creep around. You see possibility of a story. The gap has opened. Like what is there instead of a self? Another thing I learned about story, not from McKee actually, this one, was the difference between a character's psychological need and their moral need. So their psychological need is the thing that they need to do kind of for themselves, you know, confront the ghost from their past or find their purpose, that sort of thing. But their moral need is something different. Their moral need is the thing that they are doing that is hurting those around them, but of which they are not aware. And I used to live in this Psychonauts commune back when I first became a single mum, when my daughter was about two. Oh, Psychonauts is just a fancy word for people who experiment with psychedelic drugs. Some of them whilst doing PhDs, but most of them not. Anyway, and so we were all sat around the big communal dinner table one night, and I was banging on about this whole difference between the character's psychological need and their moral need. And I kind of mused to myself, you know, I wonder what my moral need is. I wonder what it is that I'm doing that's inadvertently hurting those around me. And there was this kind of clatter of cutlery as everybody stopped eating. And when I looked up, it was clear they all knew exactly what my moral need was. And they said, sort your nits out! Oh, God, nits! Oh, God, me and my daughter, we had nits for years. And we gave them to the Psychonauts. And we gave them to the Psychonauts' friends. And this disturbed their psychonautical adventures. One dreadlocked Psychonaut, he had to dip his head in a bucket of diesel to get some sleep from me. And another woman, sad to relate this one, she had to be sectioned after she'd been tripping. And this knit had fallen out of her hair, landed on her pillow, and told her the meaning of life. I mean, to be fair, the knit was probably tripping too. But so ghastly was the meaning of life that she just couldn't resist the urge to reach out and swoosh. And that was the moment she went. And she went on to give tripping knits to the entire psychiatric. Oh, my moral need, my moral need. I couldn't do it, you know, my daughter's hair was so thick and the knits were so overwhelming and I was so morally bankrupt. And so it wasn't for, oh God, good, best part of a year, really, until I came across this woman in London who was guaranteeing to get rid of knits by hoovering them out with these special attachments. And she had this whole fantastic fleet of women who wore these white Barbarella-style outfits with Lice Assassin emblazoned across the chest. And yeah, she sorted out my daughter's knits. She sorted out mine. And before I knew it, I was running my own franchise of this business from my back room in Brighton. I ran this knit emporium for 3 years or something, hoovering the knits of the rich. And then one day, I was hoovering a particularly infested, infuriatingly ungrateful teenager, and I realised I can never look at another knit. I said, I'm so sorry, and I just sent her away, half-picked. I'm sorry, there is something I must do. And I closed the business, and that was the end of that. And it was only afterwards that I realised what must have happened was this. I must have finally hoovered up as many knits as me and my daughter had originally spread, you see. The cosmic score was vanquished my moral need. Was not Robert McKee, it was my dad. It was watching his one-man shows night after night after night. It was cheaper than a babysitter. And even the great man Robert McKee himself said that my dad was the greatest storyteller that he'd ever known. And he was touring around his first one-man show, the one I mentioned, The Recollections of a Furtive Nudist. He was kind of touring it, you know, above fetish pubs and beneath occult bookshops, that kind of thing. But then, as luck would have it, his old mate Richard Eyre got the gig of being artistic director of the National Theatre. And suddenly, Ken's got a National Theatre commission for his next one-man show. Richard said, but Ken, do we know what form it's going to take? Yeah! It's not stand-up comedy. It's sit-down tragedy. It's a comic, epic, science fiction, conspiracy weeping. You do know, says Richard, that our audiences, they're not as bright as the ones you're used to. You're used to your loyal bunch who'll turn up in some park-converted bacon-curing works. And they really come to be there, you know, they've come to be there with you. Ours have come more to have been there. So I should keep it short. No, ours like to suffer. No, that's all become part of it. No, I'm just a bit concerned. You see, our last one-man show was this dangling French-Canadian. I think they might be a bit phased if they find themselves following yours.
Ow.
So make it obscure. Yes, no, do make it obscure. But not so obscure that it couldn't be cleared up in a few lines from theatre critic Michael Coveney. Anyway, what Dad actually goes on to write for the National Theatre is this here. Pigspurt. The synopsis of which is as follows. Having had it pointed out to him by Buster Bloodvessel, the lead singer of the pop group Bad Manners, who also drank at the Anchor and Hope pub, that Ken's nose looks like a woman's bottom. You see there, the back, you see, and there's the crevice of the buttocks, there's the legs going back. See there, you in front, you see that? And you can't see her hair, because she's washing it. Anyway, having had this pointed out, my dad then becomes obsessed with finding the woman whose ass matches his nose. And through this depraved pursuit, involving things like cunny sneezers and carnal nozzleage and all sorts, he accidentally invokes Pigspurt, a demonic entity that he first learns about from Philip K. Dick. Philip K. Dick, yes? Yeah. Valis, vast, active, living, intelligent system. My dad was, he was a post-Valis dickhead, not as keen as the pre-Pink Light books, not so much for him. Anyway, but it's in the Dick's exegesis in the glossary that we find the definition of pigspurt. Pigspurt. Philip K. Dick often felt that there dwelled within his psyche what seemed to be a second, entirely other self, Pigspurt, a malevolent force that had filled him with a craven attitude toward governmental authority. At times, Dick believed that the identity of this second self was the late James A. Pike. Incidentally, that's Bishop Pike, the heretical bishop of California who came to believe that Jesus was a mushroom. This quest continues to find the woman whose ass matches my dad's nose. But then one night, as he's climbing out of his bathtub, he happens to catch sight of his own ass in the mirror and realizes 'twas his own ass he saw.
the brilliant Daisy Campbell and her tribute show, Daughter of Pigspert. I hope you enjoyed that. Thanks very much to Daisy for allowing us to record her. She's going to be talking more next time about her father on a personal level. I had a chat with her in a pub after the show. Always the best time to get people. Apologies for one or two of some of the language in that. Of course, it's a fairly adult show. And thanks again to the British Library for allowing me to record Daisy's show. It's finished now as a live performance, but this will be, of course, on the londonliterarypubcrawl.com podcast page in the next couple of weeks if you want to listen again. And I will be playing more of Daisy's show next week on this programme. I'm into spoken word at the moment. There's some fantastic stuff I saw at the Edinburgh Festival. And in fact, we've arranged our own. It's a new spoken word night. I thought I might give it a mention. It's called the Speakeasy Cabaret. It happens at the Wheatsheaf Pub in Rathbone Place, just north of Oxford Street in Fitzrovia. And I'm giving it a try, really, just to see how it works. We're doing the first Saturday of every month. Yes, I know, a spoken word event on a Saturday. Who'd have thought? Admission is either a fiver or a tenner. And to try and make it a bit more of an attractive proposition, it's my insecurity coming to the fore here, the first half are speakers, anyone. So if you'd like to get involved, just turn up. Won't cost you anything to get in if you're a speaker. And then you can speak up to 10 minutes. The only qualification, the only rules are that it must be your own story and it must be true. And then in the second half, we've had sort of celebrated acts from the Edinburgh Festival. So we had Greg, who came and did his word show, Greg Byron. We also had Ian Smith, who did his hilarious My Father, the War Hero. We've got Jacqueline Haig as well. She's going to be doing her Goddess show. This month, the 1st of December, we've got Zoe Antonidis, who's done a hilarious kind of Greek Christmas story. So, yes, if you're around, or if you'd like to know any more, then, of course, get in touch with me. And the easiest way to get in touch with me is via email. radio@mavericktheatre.co.uk. radio@mavericktheatre.co.uk. But that's it for this time. Thanks very much for your company. I hope you have a fantastic literal week. Hey, that's a bit of a payoff, isn't it? I could be on an American chat show. Anyway, I'll think on that. Yeah, okay. All right, thank you for your company. I'll see you next time. I'm Nick Hennigan. This is Resonance 104.4 FM.